Luke 21, 5 through 28. I've entitled our message, Ain't Nothing Sacred Anymore. And that'll be explained as we get into this a little bit farther. There was a small college town, and in it there was this tavern frequented by a lot of the college students. And they ran a ad in the campus newspaper that, and this was during the parents' weekend. This is what the ad said. Bring your parents for lunch Saturday and we'll pretend we don't know you. The chaplain of the college got a hold of this and posted a kind of revised ad in the on the campus bulletin board, and it read, bring your parents to chapel Sunday and we'll pretend we know you. The temple was beautiful at the time of Jesus, and people were showing up to temple, but unfortunately they were still playing temple, just like kids would get together and pretend and play house or play another game. That kind of sets up our scene for chapter 21 and verse 5. Now understand, verse 1 through 4 that we talked about 2 weeks ago was the widow's mite. So there we pictured up on the Temple Mount, Jesus and the disciples hanging out, people watching. Sitting there amongst the, it was a little covered colonnade, and sitting there and watching the entrances to the, well, what's known as the Court of the Women up to the temple proper. And with that, we talked about the 13 little receptacles that stood about 3 feet high in the shape of a trumpet made out of brass, where people would come and give their tithes and their offerings and their love gifts and that, and they would pour their coins. Some of the more wealthy pouring in a lot of change, you could hear it all, and then hearing this widow's mite that went plink, plink as she put in her mites. And that started the conversation. Still sitting in that same place, still thinking about the donations to the temple, this comes up. Verse 5. Then as some spoke of the temple and how it was adorned or decorated with beautiful stones and donations, he said, these things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. And so they asked him, saying, Teacher, but when will these things be, and what sign will there be when these things are about to take place? And he said, Take heed that you do not, that you not be deceived, for many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and the time is drawn near, therefore do not go after them. But when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for these things must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately. And they said unto him, Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There'll be great earthquakes in various places and famines and pestilences, and there will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. This is known as the Mount of Olivet Discourse. And so it's on the Mount of Olives, and he's given one of the top three sermons that he gives during his time here on earth, or at least that we have recorded. And, well, Matthew chapter 24 and 25, he takes two whole chapters to explain that. So he gives the most detail. Mark, again, gives his Reader's Digest version of what had taken place, and same with Luke. Luke spins his more towards the destruction of the temple less than 40 years away in AD 70. And so that's what our focus is going to look at. How beautiful was this temple at the time? Because they're saying, wow, look at its stones. Now, don't picture river rock. Don't picture little stones. Picture stones the size of a bus. We've seen them. Matter of fact, we're going back to Israel next March from March 6th through March 20th, and we'll have the details by next Sunday. But anyways, one of the things we do is we go down underneath or right next to where the Wailing Wall is. It's underneath there, and you go all the way down and see some of Herod's stones. These things are huge. And so to be able to take this giant, massive limestone or sandstone, these stones about, again, the size of a bus, and to be able to carve them out and get them in place, it's just fantastic to be able to see this. You've heard me quote from a guy named Josephus, a historian that was at the time. Josephus, born in AD 37, he was a Jew. A lot of problems with Rome at the time, and there was a big revolt just before AD 70, so late 60s, that he didn't want to be a part of, but ends up leading this revolt up in the Galilee area. So here is a man who grew up as a boy seeing this temple, and he's going to describe it. I'm going to read it in a minute. Well, I'll read it right now. Here's what he says. He says, Now the outward face of the temple in its front wanted nothing that was likely to surprise either men's minds or their eyes, for it was covered all over The plates of gold of great weight and the first rising of the sun reflected back with a very fiery splendor and made those who forced themselves to look upon it to turn their eyes away, just as they would have done at the sun's own rays. But this temple appeared to strangers when they were at a distance like a mountain covered with snow, for as to those parts of it that were not gilt, they didn't have the gold on it. They were exceedingly white. There's another place that says there was these golden vines, these grape vines on it, and those clusters of grapes hung as tall as a man's height. Josephus, this historian that's writing from a Jewish perspective, ends up, because they ransacked the temple, ends up was taken back to Rome, ends up getting tied in with the emperor, two of the emperors at the time, Flavius and another one, Titus. And with Flavius, he gets so locked in with his family, he ends up changing his name to Flavius Josephus. And so he's able to write from a historical perspective and a Roman perspective. And he's writing this, and he has a lot more to say about the temple. But all that to say is it was impressive. You would see this saying, if our building out front is a little less than 30 feet high, it's 40 feet high. All of these stones are polished white. What you don't see in white is all gold. And with that, it's just a magnificent thing. And so there they are up on the Temple Mount looking at this saying, man, look at these stones. Look at the decorations, all the people that donated for this gold and looking at all of that. And Jesus looks at it and says, it's all coming down. All that gold that was on there because of the big fire on the inside getting the last people out melted into the cracks. They started removing stone by stone to get the gold that had melted in there and end up this prophecy being fulfilled in A.D. 70. Hey, Jesus, pretty nice temple, huh? Yeah, but it's coming down. Not one stone's going to be on top of it. Hey, Jesus, nice church building we're building. Yeah, but one day I'm going to rapture my church, the true church, up into me and these buildings. Well, somebody else can use. Hey, Jesus, my body is a temple, and so check out my physical body here. Well, yeah, but one day your body's going to fall down to the ground, and it's just going to be dust. But where then will your soul and your spirit be? See, a lot of times we have this problem of focusing on the outside and forgetting about the inside. Jesus always points us to the eternal perspective. He's always getting us back to looking on the inside. See, there's got to be a caution every time that we place our admiration on the outwardly religious life of ourselves individually or as a church or on churchianity as a whole. A mortician has a very difficult job. His job is to take a lifeless body and look like it has life. That'd be a very difficult thing to do, and I've done many of funerals, and they do a good job at what they do, but they never look like they're just laying there sleeping. They look dead. It's the same with professing Christians. They're doing the same. They're doing their best to look alive spiritually, but Jesus is shaking his head saying, no, that's you're missing the whole point. It was the Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard who once said that it is so much easier to become a Christian when you aren't one than to become one when you assume you already are. So many people think they already are, and that aspect of being a professing Christian, and he's saying, quit playing the game. He never liked when somebody was playing the religious game. He wanted it to be truth. He wanted it to be a reality. The temple is set up as something. Here he's saying the temple's going to get destroyed, and they're saying, really? You're kidding. One of the times that the disciples just said, when and where? They didn't say, it's not so, Lord, but they did back in Jeremiah's day. Because there they had the temple. It was Solomon's temple at the time. And in the late 500s BC, he's saying the same thing. Temple's going down. And they're going, no way. See, the story's back in Jeremiah 7. It takes the whole entire chapter of all of their religiosity. Matter of fact, they had this little cheerleading thing up in verse 4 of Jeremiah 7, where they said, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these. Rah! You know, I don't know, some chant kind of thing that they do. And he says, well, what are you saying? What are you doing? He ultimately says to them in verse 7, I'll cause you to dwell in this place in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. He says, behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit. Then he goes through a whole list of sins that they're doing. And then in verse 10, and then they come and stand before me in this house, speaking of the temple, which is called by my name. And then they say, we are delivered to do all these abominations. He says, what are you thinking? It's like us, it's like those that profess Christianity and saying, I raised my hand 20 years ago. It's never changed my life. I've never done anything about it. But I went forward. I raised my hand and I did this. And with it, he said, so you think you can just live your life how you please, still call yourself a Christian and accept to be saved in the end? He's saying, no way. And he made the statement in verse 12, go now to my place, which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it. See, the other thing, there's no way that he's going to dust Solomon's temple. It ain't going to happen. That's God's house. And he says, have you visited Shiloh? Now, on one of our teams, we got to visit Shiloh. Now it's under Palestinian control, and we can't tour in that area anymore. But we got to go Shiloh. So let me tell you what was there. Rocks. Just, that's it. Just a bunch of rocks. It was just leveled to the ground. There it was. And a bunch of pottery. And there's so much broken pottery, they could say, this is one of the few places they say, take as much pottery as you want. We grabbed a handful of this pottery. And so I have it up in my office, a handful of pottery. That's what's left of Shiloh. Shiloh was the first place as soon as the children of Israel come out of the wilderness, they get in the land of Israel. They didn't go to Jerusalem. That was still held by the Jebusites, and so they end up in Shiloh. And so God has them erect the tabernacle there for 40 years. That is Earth's religious hub, this place called Shiloh. He says, what's in Shiloh? It's a bunch of rocks. He says, don't think that I wouldn't do it to this place. Take that one place further. He tells us in Corinthians chapter 6, and verse 19 and 20, he says, did you know your body's a temple? See, God's not hanging out in a tent or tabernacle anymore. He's not making his home in temples anymore. It was destroyed. What he chose to do is to live in human beings that would allow them, that would say, Jesus, please come live inside. And so thus he says that your body is now my dwelling place on earth. It's going to be this portable, like motorhomes, kind of can cruise around. It's no longer stationary in one place. They can move. And so with our bodies, they can move around. But don't ever get so caught up in the body, because he tells us in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 5, there'll be times in individuals' life where all of a sudden they're just letting their body do whatever, sexual immorality, drugs, and everything else, that are believers that are letting themselves go to that. He says, I'll kill their flesh to save their soul and spirit. Now, don't come up afterwards and say, hey, I know of a situation where this happened. Is that what happened there? I don't know. I don't know when he does that. If he only does it every once in a while, I really don't get when that happens. All I'm saying is, don't ever think your temple, don't ever think your synagogue, don't ever think your church, and don't ever think your physical body is out of the reach of God saying, enough, because he's not into the physical stuff here. He's into the spiritual that lasts forever, and that's where he places his investment. See, a temple can only be a sanctuary as a sanctuary. But when man takes over, God leaves. Man takes over, God leaves. And maybe the challenge to us this morning is to look at, and my body, soul, and spirit, originally I gave it all to the Lord, but, well, is there any area that you've brought back that's taken to be yours? Do you want him to get to the place to be able to say, okay, Brian, you can have it. That area is yours. And to be able to just give it back and just leave that area, aspect of your life? No way. Well, let's go on back to in Luke 21 there. It starts, he's saying this temple's going to be destroyed. And they're going, wow, when? Well, when they asked, saying in verse 7, well, when do these things be and what sign will there be? Show us a sign. What signs can we be looking for? The signs sometimes are a little bit, they're hard to read. I don't know if you can remember all the way back to 1971. There was a band called the Five Man Electric Band. They had one big hit, and it was called Signs. A little Canadian band. And the chorus, you might remember, said, signs, signs, everywhere is signs, blocking out the scenery, breaking my mind. Do this. Don't do that. Can't you read the signs? And it's a kind of hippie's revolt against all the signs and everybody trying to tell me what to do. And very last line, he finds himself in church. He can't tithe because he doesn't have any money on him because he was a poor hippie. And he ends up making a sign is kind of how the whole song, he writes out a sign thanking the Lord for his life. So whatever it meant by all of it, I don't know. But the point back to the aspect of signs, signs, everywhere signs, they're saying, what are the signs going to be? But see, sometimes you and I have read signs, and they can be read a couple different ways. Like the sign in California that said, fishing for children only, limit 3. What does that mean exactly? In Maui, Hawaii, there's a sign that said, bottomless pit, 65 feet deep. In Austin, Texas, it says, please be aware that the balcony is not on ground level. That was on this balcony. Anyways, in South Dakota, it said Safe Haven Small Animal Hospital, and then right after it, it said Hunter's Welcome. It's just the pictures that it conjures up in your mind. In Los Angeles, another sign that said caution, blind drivers backing out. Another one in LA, it said antique tables made daily. One more in Wisconsin, it said Happy Easter, we rent handguns. I say that to say, as we read through this and we read about end times, some would have you to think that we got it all figured out, and I'm trying to say we don't, because we're going to keep looking at this and say, is he still talking about the destruction of the temple at AD 70, or is he talking about the end times? And I think it kind of goes back and forth. I think it relates to both. I think he's speaking to his immediate audience, telling them what's coming up within that next generation, but then also is telescoping, looking out into what would happen in the tribulation. So I will do my best in going through this in explaining the signs. Now understand, they thought, the Jewish mindset was, temple gets destroyed, Jesus comes back, Messiah takes over, new order. He's got to get it into their mind. No, you're going to see this take place with the temple there, AD 70. Here we are in 2007, still hasn't taken place. Let me explain that there's something happening called the church period in between all of that, so don't think it's automatically going to happen. And so he'll say a number of times, like at the end of verse 9, the end will not come immediately. And then he'll say, this must take place first. Okay, when you see that, okay, that's the beginning of things, and so that's kind of the terminology. But ultimately, that's what he's trying to get across to them. Don't think that the kingdom starts at AD 71. You know, that's not it. Verse 10 and 11. Nation rising against nation, kingdom against kingdom. Great earthquakes, various places, famines, pestilences, fearful sights, great signs from heaven. This one seems to spring towards that end of that tribulation time that's still out into the future there. Being ready for the kingdom was the purpose of the teaching. Not talking about the rapture here, that addresses that in different places. Again, dealing with their immediate application, that's a lot of those things right there is what they were able to see in their own lifetime. But again, it's also things that we'll see in the tribulation time. It seems then that signs are like, well, like continuous signs. And I think that's the point. Somebody came up after last service and says, My mom's been a Christian a long time, and it just seems lately that she's lost her hunger or drive for the Lord's second coming. Still believes in it, but just all of a sudden she's thinking back in the times with Hitler and the times where different times that she grew up in where for sure this guy must be the Antichrist, for sure this must be where we're on the brink of all these things, but I think it's exactly the point Jesus is trying to show. These guys living in the first century, they thought it was all about them and their time period, and it was all going to happen right there. We in 2007, we are looking at it and we're thinking, oh my gosh, we watch CNN, Fox News, see what's going on in the world. It has to be like this year and everything in between. I guarantee if you were alive during the time of Hitler and all that, you'd be looking at the guy as Antichrist. And you go back through some of the Russian dictators and you go back through all of history in that way, and there's so many different times. That's his point. That's exactly what he was trying to do. He wants every single human that is going to be alive until he comes back again to have that same exact mindset. Because what's this all about? Well, I want you to be ready. Be ready. He says in verse 8, 28, 31, 34, 35, 36. That's how many times he's saying, be ready and watchful, be ready and watchful. If each one of these different times periods, see, sometimes it's a frustrated, like this gal's mom that I was talking to, and she's saying, you know, it just seems like, as I look now back in history, it seems like everybody was saying he's coming and he didn't. And it seems like he was coming and he didn't. And that's why Peter wrote 2 Peter chapter 3. Don't give up hope. He's coming. We're supposed to have this anticipation. Every generation should heed its warnings. What he's looking at is with you and with I. Oh, he is coming back. And his return is imminent for his church. Me at any time, could be before the end of this sermon. Are you specifically, in the attitude of your heart, made ready and really anticipating Christ's return? It was the challenge of the first century, and it's a challenge to ours. And we ought to have that expectation. And granted, I got saved in 1980, and I was sure Jesus was coming back in 81. And I had some tweaky years after that of going, I was for sure it was then. Everything that I heard preached was 81 because of the calculations that were done by some and looking at that. And I did have to go through that time where I'm thinking, well, they said he was, and he didn't. Is he still? And I think that's very normal for all of us. But the point is, every single time period from what was happening then to what's happening today should be expecting. That's how we built this whole end time scenario. Let's go on to 12 through 19. He says, but before all these things, they're going to lay their hands on you and persecute you and delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You'll be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. But it'll turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what will be what you will answer. For I'll give you a mouth and wisdom, which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. You'll be betrayed even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends. They'll put some of you to death. You'll be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. But your patience, by your patience, possess your souls. Persecution. A lot of times we see persecution as a threat. He says, please don't understand persecution as a threat. Persecution equals opportunity. This is where I will use you. I'll use your testimony, your story, your God story, and that's where I'm going to give you time to teach it. You're not at those times to throw you in prison. You're not going to get to go do a Bible study and plan for this. No, Holy Spirit's just going to show you on the spot what to be able to share during that time. Now, first century, could they relate to it? Yeah, it's exactly what happened before AD 70 and them coming in. There was a lot of persecution that was there with the next two emperors as they started pouncing on Christians at that time. We have part of the story in the book of Acts, so they can relate to that. Any persecution going on in our world today? Yes. Hundreds of thousands of Christians being thrown in prison, being killed over in Africa. There's a number of things happening like that. Can that relate to them today? Absolutely. During the times of the tribulation? Absolutely. Again, it's able to fit in each of these time periods, but he's saying, listen, don't see persecution as threat. You need to have the mindset that this is simply any trial, any tribulation, any persecution, this is your hour. This is your finest hour. This is the time where you get to speak up. This is the time where you get to tell them about the goodness of God. Verse 16. A little bit of a problem here. Oh, some of you are going to die. Okay, so it's not an automatic everybody, you don't get touched. But wait a minute, 16 says you might die, and 18 says not a hair of your head should be lost. Well, how do you put that together? Well, it's like this. It's the time where Jesus said, be not afraid of those who can kill the body. After that, they have no more that they can do to you. That's great. That's the point there. Yes, your physical body might die, but I guarantee nothing ever, ever, ever will happen to your soul and spirit. Because to be absent from your now dead body is to be present with me to one day give you a brand new body. So don't worry about your old body. And so we have the combination of the two, how a body can be destroyed and yet your hair in the figurative sense be not touched because you're protected for all eternity. Let's jump to verse 20. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. And let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. And let not those who are in the country enter her, for these are the days of vengeance, that all the things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. And they'll fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captives into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Relate to AD 70? Sure, that's exactly what happened then. But I think this section all the more is more telescopic of speaking the time of the tribulation. I believe that because in Revelation 12, it tells the same story. People taken off, fleeing to the hills of Judea, hiding out in the rock city of Petra and hiding out in that day and basically doing these exact same things here. I want our focus to be on verse 24 because he's saying Jerusalem would be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Gentiles are going to oversee Jerusalem, or especially the Temple Mount, because that's what he's talking about earlier with the temple in that way, from now until the second coming of Jesus. When he comes back, sets up his throne, that's when the Jews get to take over again. That's where he, the Jewish Messiah, comes over and takes over again. Hey, how's Jesus doing in his prophecy so far? That's pretty bold prophecy. He could have said, you know, that's easy to say right then because Rome was in charge, right? Daniel 2 had already prophesied it would be Babylon. When they were in the, when Israel was in its heyday, and all of a sudden he's saying, Babylon's going to, no way, Babylon's not going to take us over. Yeah, Babylon's going to take over. They're going to become the world ruler. No way. Well, they did. After that, the Medes and Persians. Then a guy named Alexander the Great shows up, and so Greece is in charge. He turns it over to his four generals, and right after that, Rome takes charge until AD 324. After the Romans were in charge, then it became the Byzantine Empire. After the Byzantine Empire were the Persians. After the Persians, the Muslim Arabs. After the Arabs, the Egyptians. Then we go through the time of the Crusaders, ultimately to the Turks, and finally in World War I, Britain takes it over and then turns it over to the League of Nations, ultimately to the United Nations, and overseeing all of that. In 1947, the world feels bad for Israel because of the Holocaust, gives them back their land, and they immediately turn over and give to the Muslim Council the temple to watch over the temple site. So still to this day, there is Gentiles overseeing the Temple Mount. How's Jesus doing? Pretty good in his prophecy in the last 2,000 years. It's been exactly that, of this aspect of the Gentiles being in control of Jerusalem. And it's going to be that way until he comes back. That's what that section is for. Lastly, we'll wrap up in 25 through 28. And there's going to be signs in the sun, in the moon, and in the stars, and on the earth. Distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's heart failing them from fear, and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Verse 28, now when these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws nigh. Again, this has nothing to do with the rapture. It's not what's being spoken of here. This very ending here is definitely the end of the tribulation, the beginning of when Christ comes back and starts his thousand-year, the millennial reign, the kingdom rule that's there. It's really not answering, it's mentioning the signs in verse 25 and 26, but more importantly, it's talking about this aspect of the effect of the signs, what they're doing, men's hearts failing them from fear, having heart attack, watching these signs that are taking place around the earth here. Not to be looking for signs, be looking for the Savior. So when he comes back, here's what's going to happen. See, at the rapture, no eye is going to see him. It's just quick, just immediate, and it just happens, like they say, in the twinkling of an eye. But when Christ comes down the next time, every eye shall see him, Revelation chapter 1, verse 7. And so as he's coming back, you have the people that are alive at the end of tribulation, seeing him coming and looking up. And that aspect of looking up is the expression of joy. Their countenance has lifted, and their face is lighting up. At a time where everything was just in a chaotic state and out of control, he returns. But again, his focus in all of this, and he'll end this chapter, and we'll take that next week. He'll end the chapter with the aspect, are you waiting and are you watching? The attitude of the Christian should ever be that of the lifted head, joy, and a light upon the face, knowing that any moment he may come. Redemption is really the reason the believers can stand up and lift up their heads. Especially the end, they see their redemption draws close. Here he comes. The redemption's finally being completed, and so they look up with excitement. What's the danger for you and I in the meanwhile? Thought he was coming, hasn't come back yet. Peter again in 2 Peter chapter 3 saying, don't let that discourage you. There's been people running around, the naysayers, saying, oh, they talked about that back in my dad's generation. Don't let that discourage you either. Jesus is coming again. In the meanwhile, caution is complacency. Our caution is just living for gratification. Our caution is being lulled to sleep as if he's not coming back. Our caution can be inactivity or religiosity or simple apathy. We need to stop grooming our exterior and start renovating the interior, because he says, where is your attitude? What is your attitude towards Jesus coming again? We might ask, well, How do we keep that attitude? How do we get it? How do we overcome our enemy? How do we be ready to meet Jesus? Where will we find the power to be able to do so? What do we do in the meanwhile? How do we live a life that's victorious? And I see a great maybe answer to that in Revelation 12 and verse 11, where it said, speaking of those saints in the middle of the tribulation period, but I think we can relate it to us. It says, they overcame him, meaning the devil, by the blood of the Lamb, it's going back to the cross, by the word of their testimony, they spoke up about their God, and they did not love their lives to their death. They put it all on the line. How do we relate that to ourselves? Well, this aspect, how to become overcomers, how to walk victorious and all of that. Well, it all goes back to what Christ did on the cross. Ever keep that in your mind. Second aspect, speak up. Tell your God story and what God's done in your life. Third, learn how to die to yourself daily. Not putting yourself as number one, not lifting yourself up and making all this world and all this life about you, but learn how to deny yourself. Those seem to be three awesome areas: looking back to the cross, speaking up about your God, and the third aspect of laying it all down, putting it all in the line. I'll close with this. If you want to be distressed, look within. If you want to be defeated, look back. If you want to be distracted, start looking around. If you want to be dismayed, look ahead. But if you want to be delivered, he says, look up. Let's pray.